Well, hello everyone, and hope you've been enjoying Evil a Day so far. For our next little feature here, I'm pleased to welcome John B. Morgan, who, as far as I can see, is as responsible as anyone for getting the works of Evil into the English speaking world. I think you were involved in the production of, what, 10 Evola books that came out?
I'd have to think, but close to that, certainly, yeah.
And, so I'll just start with my first question, which is, how did you become interested in Evola, and what drew you to him?
Well, I've been interested in Evola for a long time, and it kind of came together as a result of two other interests of mine, which were... I was getting interested in the right, you know, the political right, what Evola calls the true right, I guess you could say, in my 20s. And I also was starting to become interested in spirituality after having been, you know, pretty much a materialist earlier in life. And I gave up on being interested in politics for a few years because I couldn't really see how it hooked up with the sorts of things that concerned me. I don't think you can find the meaning of life or the purpose of our lives in economics or, you know, the color of people's skin or things like that. But I first came across Evola purely by chance in a bookshop in 1996. They had a copy of Evola's Revolt Against the Modern World, which I'd never heard of Evola before that time. And I picked it up because, as I recall, the cover blurb called him the Italian Spengler or something like that. And that's not really a very accurate a description, but it intrigued me because I was, excuse me, already interested in Spengler at that time in my life. So I picked it up and I tried reading it, but you know, I was 23 at the time. And it didn't really make any sense to me because I didn't really have much experience of esotericism or religion, so forth. But then a few years passed, and I started to get more interested in that, and also interested in the European New Right, the French school that was founded by Alain de Benoist and you know, branched out all over Europe subsequent to that. And I started to think about Evola again because I started to come across his name and a lot of those writings. And I thought, well, he's somebody I should go back and look at again. So, you know, I dusted off that copy of Revolt Against the Modern World that I had and plowed my way through that and read a couple of the other books that were available at that time. And I realized that here was somebody who could link what we see happening on the mundane political world to the higher realm of meaning. And Evola is certainly not for everybody. I mean, the sort of everything for him relates back to tradition. And in order to not only to believe in tradition, but to understand tradition, you have to acknowledge that there is a higher reality above the material world. And that it has a certain order and meaning to it. I've encountered people who are atheists before who tell me they're interested in Evola, and I really can't fathom what they get out of him because the atheistic perspective is, you know, completely contrary to everything that Evola believed in. So for me, he was distilling the essence of what, you know, all the interests that I had, but also what I see as the purpose of life itself, which is to learn about these higher truths that lie behind the reality that we see in everyday life, including but not only politics. But I should mention as well, for people who are new to Evola, I think it's very important for people who want to get seriously into Evola to familiarize themselves with René Guénon as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who came before Evola. And even though Evola's own approach to tradition is quite different from Guénon's in some ways, I really don't think you can fully understand Evola without having at least some familiarity with Guénon, because you know, Abel himself read Genon, and that's what led him to start talking about tradition and, you know, many of the concepts that he used, you'll also find in Genon in some cases, explicated in greater detail.
Yeah, I have a couple of, I've read a couple of his books, you know, The Crisis of the Modern World, which was the direct inspiration for a revolt, and also another very good book, which is The Reign of Quantity.
Yes, yes.
Which I think gets at the, that one's pretty fundamental, I think, for getting at the real problem, because I've been reading a lot of Evelyn over the past few days, and it just struck me how much The Reign of Quantity comes up as a basic idea of the problem with modernity, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Those are probably his two most fundamental books, although I'd also recommend East and West, An Introduction to the Study of the Hindu Doctrines, for the more metaphysical side of things. But those are the two books where Genon really attacks modernity.
Yeah, just out of interest, that copy of Revolt that you found in 1986, was that an English copy or an Italian copy?
96.
Oh, 96, yes,
it was the Inner Traditions edition, the same one that you can get today.
Good, great. Yeah, I was just wondering. Okay.
I don't read Italian, unfortunately. I wish I did, but no, I rely on the English translations.
Which English editions of his works have you personally worked on?
Well, before I was involved with Arctos, we had another publishing imprint with some friends of mine that we called Integral Tradition Publishing. And we explicitly wanted to take on, there were many ideas that we had, but as far as Abel is concerned, we wanted to do those works that Inner Traditions, which is a more mainstream, you know, one could say sort of new age publisher on esotericism, that it seemed like they were more hesitant to delve into certain areas of Abel's thoughts. So we were impatient, and we knew many other people who were too, who were English readers who wanted to know about these works. So that was one of the reasons we started ITP. And the very first book that we published in March 2007 was Metaphysics of War, which is a collection of essays that Evola wrote in the 30s and 40s. And some people say it's an ideal introduction. I don't know that I would recommend it as the first Evola book that somebody would read, although I guess it is more accessible than many of his other works. But he does try to get into the meaning of tradition for somebody who's in conflict with the modern world, especially, you know, during the time of World War II. If you want to grasp what his thought process was like at that time in terms of being committed politically or, you know, being a soldier and so forth, you can find that in that book. And of course, some of that stuff has significance beyond simply the time he wrote them in. So it's definitely worth reading. That was the first one. And I did edit that one. We did one other Evola book through ITP, and that's The Path of Cinnabar, which is Evola's autobiography, which is a much more important book than Metaphysics of War. And then at the end of 2009, we ended up joining up with some new people, and ITP became Arctos. And I was the editor-in-chief of Arctos for the first 7 years that it was around. So I edited all the Evola books that Arctos produced up to early 2017. So, you know, we reissued Metaphysics of War and The Path of Cinnabar. And what else did we do? Well, we did Evola's three main books on fascism. There's Fascism Viewed from the Right, which is about Italian fascism. Then there's Notes on the Third Reich. And there was a last one that doesn't actually have an Italian title, so we gave it one of our own, which is A Traditionalist Confronts Fascism. And that's miscellaneous essays that Evola wrote on that topic. And then we also published a book called A Message for Right-Wing Youth, which was originally produced in Hungarian for the Jobbik political party here in Hungary. And we had that translated to English from the Italian, mm-hmm. except for the introduction, which had been in Hungarian. I feel like I'm forgetting something, but I can't remember what it was. I think we did at least one other book of Aveles while I was with Arctos. And I also did work mainly as a proofreader on the edition of East and West that Countercurrents published a few years ago, which is miscellaneous essays that Avila had published in an Italian journal after the war. There's no real unifying theme apart from many of the essays are about comparing and contrasting the Western and Eastern mm-hmm. philosophical and spiritual traditions. And I also, oh, go ahead, please.
I just had a couple of little questions on those, because I think I have all of the everything that Arctos have brought out on Avila. I have mm-hmm. in beautiful hardcover, because I really do think, but I had to ask, like, what was the production on those books is very high quality, especially those especially those front covers. What was the kind of process there, if you don't mind my asking? Because like, did you have a like someone who's specialized in just doing those front covers for Avila, or what? Like, what was the idea of those front covers?
Yeah, we had, well, there were actually several different cover designers who did the covers on the Avila books when I was there. I don't know who's doing the more recent ones, but we had cover designers who did this.
And then the other question I had was that I've been trying to uncover, you know, in preparation for this Avila Day, his entire kind of bibliography, and I've had to buy this pamphlet journal thing that came out in 1995 in Italian. And like you, I don't read any Italian at all, but the only complete bibliography in existence is in this journal, apparently. But apparently his total bibliography runs to like over 1,000 essays, which is pretty huge. I just wonder, like, how much more Avila is out there yet to be kind of, you know, brought into the English language, to your knowledge?
Well, I mean, I have Italian friends who are familiar with his work in the original. It's not actually certain that we know of all of Avila's essays. In fact, I would imagine that if that bibliography you have was done in 1995, that there's probably been some discovered since then. So it may not be absolutely complete. But Avila never kept a catalog of his own work. So this is just what people have found. But I know that it's still suspected in Italy that there might be other things lurking in journals and so forth that we don't even know about yet, even in Italian. What was the journal that the bibliography was in, just out of curiosity?
Oh, it's called Future Present. And it's it was brought out as a special edition, number 6. I can send you the link if you want. I paid 25 euros for it, but I thought I thought it's probably a pretty good resource.
I'll get that.
it's referenced in pretty much every kind of academic introduction to Avila I've come across. It basically mm-hmm. mentioned, like, yeah, this bibliography is really exhaustive, and it goes on for many, many pages. It was done by trying to remember the name of the guy who did it now.
Renato Del Ponte.
Yeah, Renato Del Ponte, who I believe met at Avila.
He was one of his students.
Yeah, I will send that to you afterwards.
Oh, thank you. I'll just add, though, I mean, I'm sure there might be some very interesting essays of his out there where you can that aren't translated yet, where you could find out his views on various interesting topics. But I do think that all of his major work has already been translated as of now. In fact, it's only this year that sort of the last couple of pieces were fell into place. But now I think, you know, if you're an Anglophone reader, you have more than adequate resources to get a full understanding of Avila's thoughts, which is good. Because when I started, there was hardly anything.
I did notice that his earliest, like that philosophical period, was like the theory of the absolute individual. For some reason, those have not been translated, and there doesn't seem to be much interest in those. I guess it's like before his traditionalist turn, right? The very earliest stuff. There's also this fascinating sounding study called The Worker in the Work of Ernst Jünger or something like that, which also has not been translated. That's about it.
Well, that one, what I've been told, again, you know, by Italian speakers, is that Avila tried to get the rights to produce an Italian translation of Jünger's Der Arbeiter, but couldn't get it. So he decided to sort of write a summary of the book instead. So that's what that book is. Although I imagine, you know, it's not only a summary. I'm sure it has Avila's thoughts on Jünger as well. Although he wrote on Jünger in many essays as well. And I also wanted to mention, my understanding is that there are some people who say that if you really want a full understanding of Avila, that you have to read those early philosophical works of his that were in the idealist tradition. Other people I've talked to said no, that, you know, once he went to tradition, he was operating in a completely different paradigm, and it's not necessary to get into the philosophical background. So I don't know. Hopefully they will be translated one day, but I'm sure they're extremely dense and hard going, even by Avila standards. So I imagine that's why nobody's tried to do them so far.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I cut you off when I asked my last question. Was there any other works that you'd want to mention that you worked on personally?
I think I've mentioned all of them. I thought I might be forgetting one of the Arctos ones, but I don't think so now.
All right. So my next question here is, why should people read Avila today?
Well, I think it's really unfortunate that Avila has become so strongly affiliated with the political right, because I really think that while it's an important aspect of his thought, it's also the least important. I mean, obviously, Avila is mainly addressing what he would call differentiated individuals, you know, men who want to transcend the limits of the modern world. And you know, the limits of this time that we're living in. And unfortunately, Avila was obscure for a long time in the English-speaking world, but thanks to the alt-right and people like Steve Bannon, now Avila is a household word, but he's, you know, known exclusively as some kind of a fascist writer, which couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, most of his work, while you could say it's implicitly conservative on some level, like all genuine spiritual thought, of course, is implicitly conservative because it's based in the idea that there's an inherent meaning to things. But putting that aside, most of his work has nothing to do with politics at all. But it is, of course, true that he engaged with politics in Italy in his time in a sort of detached way, but he did address it. And in Europe more generally. And of course, he did write several books on racial theory as well. So that's there. But for somebody who's more interested in the esoteric, or if you want to call it the spiritual Avila, the Avila who's addressing the differentiated man, you don't really need to familiarize yourself with those works. And they're there if you want to learn about that. But I don't see it as essential to the main thrust of his work. Mm-hmm. So we can talk about the political aspects of his stuff more later, but I would hope that your listeners would understand that, you know, he's not a primarily a political thinker. He's addressing people who want to realize their transcendent selves in the modern world, you know, in the midst of a world that denies that there even is such a thing, that denies any sort of higher truths or hierarchies. Mm-hmm. So that's who it's addressed to. It's not a political doctrine. He's not calling for the restoration of the fascist party or anything like that. It's a purely metaphysical, spiritual doctrine that he's talking about. If you're interested in those ideas, that's why you should read him.
I think it's worth mentioning as well that, you know, these days when somebody says traditional, conservative, people, you know, I think people's imaginations beeline to the 1950s America, right? But in a strange way, Evola would have been against that 1950s America as anything else, as a kind of symptom of modern bourgeois thinking.
Evola despised the United States. That's evident throughout his writing. The United States, he considered the United States and the Soviet Union to be mirror images of each other. He thought they were, you know, the symptoms of just the products of the decline of civilization and, you know, the demonic forces that are released during Kali Yuga. So, no, he definitely did not see 1950s America as his ideal. We have to draw a distinction between the concept of metaphysical tradition, which is the idea that behind physical reality, there is this metaphysical realm that is ordered and that you can access through traditional practices, through religious practices. But that is distinct. That's why we use a capital T when we talk about it. That is distinct from lowercase t tradition, which is just customs that have grown up in cultures and peoples over time. And that there can be a link between lowercase t tradition and uppercase t tradition, but it depends on what type of a tradition it is. I mean, that, for example, the traditions of the Catholic Church would be linked to spiritual tradition by virtue of the fact that they're part of the exoteric practices that give you access to the esoteric essence of Catholicism. Mm. So in that sense, they can be linked, but it's okay. We can say that eating apple pie at Thanksgiving is an American tradition, but that has nothing to do with tradition as Evola talked about it.
Mm-hmm. I just thought I'd mention briefly that those racial writings, I mean, I think it's the synthesis on the doctrine of race and the myth of the blood, right? Those are the main areas where he talks about race.
He wrote other essays on it too, but those are two of the big ones, yes.
But my understanding is, and I haven't read those extensively, but I've kind of read enough to kind of get the gist of where he's going with it, is that essentially in his conception that even in the realm of race, spirit comes above blood, that the spirit, the animating spirit, trumps notions of biological or evolutionary race, to the extent that you can actually like spiritually belong to a race that you didn't actually, that you're not actually biologically part of. So you could become like, I don't know, spiritually Jewish or spiritually black, or I mean, is that more or less correct, or is there more to it?
Yes, I mean, it's a bit more complicated than that, but he basically saw racial types as Platonic forms. So you could say, like, the idea of a German, or the idea of an African, or the idea of a Jewish person, that these are all ideal types, and therefore the one that you most closely correspond to in your characteristics is the race that you belong to. But people always say that he thought that race was purely a spiritual category. If you read his writings, he clearly believed that there was a link with biology. He didn't think that there was no connection. It was just that it was possible for certain individuals to sort of transform themselves from one into another.
Yeah, but I mean, from what I could see, he was trying to, I guess, steer either the fascists or the National Socialists, or to alert them to the fact that just being like white and European would not be enough. Like, it's not enough to say, oh, me and you are white and we stand together as brothers, because that's not what's that going to do? You have to embody a certain kind of well, it's the higher ideals that we've been talking about.
Well, this isn't something that Avila even invented. I spent some time in India practicing Hinduism, or what they call Hinduism, and they teach the exact same thing. It's even when it comes to caste, if you are born into a particular caste or a particular race, but you do not conduct yourself. Well, okay, let me take an example. You know, the idea of the Aryan that we have now is, you know, of course, because of the German National Socialists, we think that Aryan is a racial category. Now, the word Aryan does appear in the ancient Hindu scriptures, but it's not a racial category. It denotes the people of higher character. But the scriptures are also clear on the fact that even if you're born into a high caste, if you conduct yourself like somebody of one of the lower castes, or even worse, somebody of no caste, then you are not an Aryan. So certainly if you take that kind of a worldview and apply it to what the German National Socialists did, or what many people on the so-called alt-right are talking about today, that's complete nonsense, because just because somebody is born to a particular race doesn't make them somehow some kind of a higher man just by virtue of their birth. So yeah, you can say that's something that's important, I think, to understand about traditionalism, and not only Avila, but Genon and the others as well, was that they didn't see themselves as creating a new doctrine. They were trying to explicate what they found in the ancient scriptures in a way that modern men could understand it. So, you know, Avila wasn't inventing any of these ideas. He was trying to extract what he found from his study of ancient traditions. Let me just add one more thing. If you Google, like, for example, earlier I was trying to find an interview with Avila that's on YouTube. So I punched in Avila interview into YouTube, and I got a bunch of videos about Steve Bannon and the alt-right. I actually had to go through several pages till I found what I was looking for, which was the actual Avila interview. And there's an entire book that's been written about Steve Bannon and traditionalism by Ben Teitelbaum. There's a little bit about me in the book as well. I don't recommend it as an introduction to Avila or traditionalism, but if you're interested in this vague influence of traditionalism on politics in recent years, there's a lot of information on that in there. And Bannon apparently has read Avila, but I don't see how you can discern any influence of Avila on Bannon's activities. And when it comes to the alt-right, if the alt-right had actually studied Avila instead of just turning him into a meme, they wouldn't have done the things that they did that caused them to self-destruct. So, it's nonsense to think that traditionalism has anything to do with racial politics or white nationalism or fascism. Well, okay, fascism is a more complicated issue, but National Socialist race theory, let's put it that way, because it doesn't.
What do you consider to be Avila's essential works and why?
Well, there's no question that his most important work is Revolt Against the Modern World. That's really the foundation stone for everything else. There's also, of course, The Mystery of the Grail, which he actually wrote as sort of a supplement to Revolt Against the Modern World. Besides that, his major works are, there's The Yoga of Power, which is about Tantra and Hinduism. And there's The Doctrine of Awakening, which is more about Buddhism, and the Hermetic tradition, and also Men Among the Ruins, which is the closest thing to a political work that he wrote. It's sort of a reassessment of the meaning of the right in light of the outcome of the Second World War and the situation that Europe found itself in the 1950s. But it's not a... a political work in the everyday sense. I mean, he's trying to get at the metaphysical essence of what the right is, which has very little to do with post-war politics in Europe. And there's, of course, The Path of Cinnabar that I worked on, which I actually think is maybe the best starting place for most people, because Evola wrote it near the end of his career, and he doesn't really say much about his life. You get a little bit, but the subtitle of it is An Intellectual Autobiography. And it's more a history of his thought process. And he goes through his early interest in Dadaism and then idealism, and then how he got into the occult and how he eventually ended up with tradition. And then he goes about offering a summary of each of his major works. So personally, I think for many people, that may be the best starting point, because it gives you an overview right off the bat. Mm-hmm. I used to suggest Revolt Against the Modern World, but a lot of people tell me they find it very difficult to get through, especially when they have no background in Evola already. So if you try that and it doesn't work for you, then maybe try reading The Path of Cinnabar instead, which also I wouldn't say is an easy read, but it's easier than Revolt Against the Modern World.
I actually think that The Path of Cinnabar is a very, and it's basically like a guide. It's like a guide written by the master himself, you know. I think if you have a little, The Path of Cinnabar is very good if you have a little bit of familiarity with him already. My thought is that the ones that are easiest to get into, just as I find as I've been trying to introduce Evola to people, I say, well, read Revolt, and they're like, what the hell is this? You know, they can't even get past the first few pages. There's a little essay called Orientations, which I think you guys put, I think, is it the first one in Handbook for Right Wing Youth?
It is, and it's also in Traditionalist Confronts Fascism.
Yeah, that's a very good kind of one-shot introduction. Also, the Bow and the Club has got a lot of, like, how can I put this? It's like, it's almost easier when Evola's talking about, like, the Beatles and women wearing jeans and things like this. As a kind of entryway to get from where we are to get to where he is, almost like through, it's like him talking about, you know, the stuff of everyday life. And I think that can kind of help people just kind of get a feel for him before hitting like the masterpieces. And maybe like The Path of Cinnabar, even before you read Revolt, something like that, would properly orientate you to kind of, because it does require preparation, I would say, unlike many other authors you can just pick up and read.
Right. I mean, I wouldn't say any of his books are easy, but certainly those are, yeah, I would agree with you about The Bow and the Club, actually. I think it would be a mistake to only read that one if you were only going to read one Evola book, but that could be a good entry point. I also, many people like Ride the Tiger. There's some Evolians I know who find it one of his less successful works, but it was near the end of his life, and he was really trying to distill how he thought somebody could differentiate himself in the modern world. It's probably a lot easier to read than most of his other books.
And also it's a lot more, Ride the Tiger is a lot more about like, how the hell can you surrounded by all this depravity and surrounded by the sheer nihilism of the modern world, how can you as an individual not succumb to the despair of it all?
So it's the closest thing he wrote to a handbook, you could say. Yes.
Yeah. It's also a response to Nietzsche as well, that book.
And the existentialists and several other modern trends. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. I actually did, just by the by, you might be interested. I've been doing quite a bit of reading around in preparation for today. And I came across I think it was a book by Paul Furlong, like a proper academic study on Evola. It came out with a Palgrave, a fairly mainstream press. And he was saying that a lot of people traditionally have thought that he wrote Ride the Tiger after his ideas in Men Among the Ruins like failed or whatever. But now scholars are saying that there's evidence that he actually wrote Ride the Tiger first. And that
I wasn't aware of that. Yeah, I haven't actually read Furlong's book, I have to say.
Yeah, Furlong advances this idea that it actually, once you know he wrote Ride the Tiger first, and the reason it came out in 1961 is because he struggled to find a publisher for it. So, you know, Men Among the Ruins, like, chronologically comes out first, but it should not be seen as a, like, a lot of people have said, oh, well, you know, Ride the Tiger is the withdrawal after the politics of Men Among the Ruins fails. Whereas Furlong says, actually, the two works are not as different as people make out. It's just, and that Men Among the Ruins is about outlining the ideal political state, you know, from the right, rather than saying, like, you need to take action now type thing.
And he also emphasized the importance of the idea of an order as opposed to a political party. You know, that was his main recommendation to people, because he didn't think that anything higher could come out of democratic politics. And of course, the political party is very much a creation of the modern democratic state. So people sometimes think that Avila advised his followers, or, you know, whatever you call them, his fans or whatever. I mean, he didn't have an organization that he led or anything. Not to get involved in politics. That's not strictly true. What I have gathered from studying him is that he thought you could, as long as you didn't get invested in modern politics as a source of meaning for yourself. And I think that is a mistake that a lot of people on the right make today, is that they, you know, they look to politics to find meaning for their lives. And Avila thought the idea of an order could protect people from that. The idea you could have the outer party for the masses, but the inner circle of the party, as it were, would have its own rights and traditions and principles that it would stand by, that would sort of, you know, keep them aloof from all the nonsense of day-to-day politics.
One of the things that really struck me when I was reading the Yoga of Power was that he says at one point, basically, in order for this to be authentic, you can't tell anyone. You cannot go around saying, "Oh, I'm going to reach the awakening through doing tantra or whatever." You have to keep it secret. He says, like, go to an island, go to somewhere that's really remote. Don't tell anyone. This seems to be like a through line in Evola's work, that you must keep it kind of secret and hidden in a way, and it's not for. Do you have any insight on that, on that idea, that things must almost like be behind closed doors?
That's true. This is where Avila parts ways with Genon, because Genon's idea of how you get back to tradition was, he said, well, you know, find those places in the world where you could still find religious institutions and orders that offer authentic initiation. And go to them, and, you know, that will be your refuge from the modern world. But Avila wasn't somebody who really advised people to go back to tradition. He believed in self-initiation, because he didn't think that any of the traditional institutions that remained in the modern world were still authentic, or that, you know, worse, that they were actually counter-traditional, that even though they offered the guise of spirituality, in fact, they were actually subversive forces. Freemasonry is one of those things. Mm-hmm. You know, Avila acknowledged that he believed that at one time Masonry had been an authentic tradition, but that it became a subversive force over time. So he actually thought that religion could not offer any real refuge in the modern world. So he seemed to urge people to seek out their own path, you know, by following these left-hand path practices. And I think this grows out of his experience with the UR group in Italy in the 1920s, which was a sort of secret society And they had occult practices, and they drew bits and pieces from various religious practices. And that seems to be where Avila himself got into contact with tradition, was through this UR group. And although he also alludes to certain Buddhist practices that he pursued. But he did not have the idea, that the traditional idea that, well, you should go and, you know, go to church every Sunday, or even, you know, go to a monastery and you know, spend your life as a monk. He didn't really have those ideas. He thought you could remain in the modern world but not be of it by secretly pursuing these practices on your own. I think that can be dangerous for some people, but Avila believed that this was the calling of the higher men, and that your religion was sort of for the more lower types, you could say.
When you say dangerous, I think in that same bit of The Ogre of Power, he does say, be careful, because if you don't know what you're doing, you could die, through asphyxiation. Like, you could literally kill yourself if you mess up, basically, which is kind of
absolutely yeah. Or worse. I have to say myself, I pursued a right hand path tradition in India for a time, and what it taught me, I don't know that I'm personally somebody who could undergo self-initiation, I have to say, because I think part of the path to esotericism is you have to be able to overcome yourself, and that means overcoming your ego. And that's one of the absolutely most difficult things for a modern person to do, of course, because we're taught that the individual is the most sacred thing in the modern world. And I think it would be very difficult to do that on your own. And I think that's how I've met people who call themselves traditionalists before, who know Avila very well, but I feel like they have imbibed all the knowledge, but their spirit is still not open to tradition on some level, that they let their ego get in the way of accessing tradition. And so that's why I think it's dangerous for some people, is that you end up with people who think that they're masters, who know everything, but who in fact are still thoroughly modern people, because they haven't learned how to overcome themselves. Mm-hmm. So this is just a personal observation, but I think Avila would agree with me.
Do you have a favorite work of Avila's, and why?
Well, I mean, Revolt's the first one I encountered, so I've always been partial to that. But I have to say, you know, the one we've already talked about, The Path of Cinnabar, is maybe the one I find the most interesting that I've read. And I do have to admit, I enjoyed reading Ride the Tiger a lot when that came out. Just because I have such a personal relationship with it, because I worked on it for so long, The Path of Cinnabar is kind of my favorite. Mm-hmm. But that's different from being the most important work.
it's kind of unique as well. I can't think of another time where somebody gives a guide to their own work. You know, it's kind of
I think he knew that he was, how difficult his work was, so I think that's why he felt the need to produce it. And even now, I like to say that Avila is someone who's more often referenced than read, because I think, you know, especially when you see people online who reference Avila, there's some exceptions, but I think in many cases there are people who have read very little or nothing, or if they have read Avila, they don't really grasp him. So that's a problem. And I think he understood that.
Could you recommend any hidden gems or off the beaten path Avila?
Yeah, for sure. You sent me the list that you posted. And it's a good one, but you are missing a few of the minor things. I mean, there were some pamphlets of Avila's work that I know of that were issued like in the 80s and 90s, and, you know, bits and pieces of things that were in magazines. Although I think that all that stuff has since been reissued. But there are a few things now that are missing. For example, some of his Dada writing has been translated. I mean, I think it's really only for Avila completists. You don't need to read that stuff to understand his idea of tradition, but there's, he wrote an essay called on abstract art, I believe, and that's been anthologized. I think the book is called Dadas on Art, and it's still in print. It was produced in the 70s originally. It's translated in there. It's just a few pages. And he also wrote this. I was actually in preparation for this question earlier. I was looking on WorldCat, you know, the global library catalog. And it seems there are a couple of his other Dada writings and anthologies I didn't even know about. So I'm going to have to order those and find out what they are. And the his long Dada poem, I forget the name of it right now, but it's translated at a website called Evola As He Is, that's been around for going on 20 years now, run by a gentleman named Bruno Cariou. And you can find a lot of interesting stuff there. And he translated Evola's Dada poem. So I'd recommend, if you're interested in that, going there. But what's more important is there is a book called Essays on Magical Idealism that was published by Charles Salvo. He also likes to go by his Italian name, which is Calogero Salvo. I apologize if he's listening and he mispronounced it. but he runs a website called Gornahor. And for people really interested in Evola, I would definitely recommend checking out that site, because the site has been going for, I think, at least 10 years now, maybe more. And a lot of the writings on there are his own, but he's also translated a lot of little bits and pieces of Evola, his letters and things like that, that have never been translated anywhere else. And he's also the only person, as far as I know, who's translated any of Evola's idealist writings from the 1920s. And you can find them all on his website, but there is a paper book that you can find on Amazon and elsewhere called Essays on Magical Idealism. And it's a compilation of both translations of things Evola wrote and Salvo's own commentary on this. So I recommend it for people if they want to know that period of his work.
Just while we mention the magic, I mean, this is something I've not really been able to get my head around. I understand the esotericism and, you know, the hermetic tradition and, you know, why he's interested in the Holy Grail and so on. But the actual the magic, I mean, can you explain this? Like, how is this related to tradition and his other? I mean, you mentioned the work he did with the UR group. I mean, I've only really kind of browsed through the introduction to magic, but like, as far as I could see, like, it's literally like draw this stuff on the floor, and he's going through like actual magic rituals in there. The sort of thing that we'd know from, like, you know, Christopher Lee Hammer horror movies of the 60s and things. How can you how does this relate to the rest of his work? I don't really understand that.
Well, I mean, if you believe in the metaphysical reality of tradition, then the occult is part of that. The question is how to determine which are the authentic rituals and which are the counter-traditional ones. And of course, in the occult these days, there's all sorts of nonsense that's published. But, you know, Evola was very much opposed to modern occultism. And, you know, there's the book of his, it was originally called The Mask and Face of Contemporary Spiritualism, but it was recently published in English as The Fall of Spirituality. And you'll get a very good take in it on what he thought of, you know, all this sort of new age spirituality and occultism and so forth. He's quite hostile to it, but he did acknowledge that there's an authentic occult tradition. And that's what he and his colleagues explored through the UR group. Although that came after his philosophical idealist stage. It was sort of the bridge between his philosophical stage and his traditional stage, you could say. But he never renounced his work with the occult. Now, I should mention that there's a massive three-volume work that's titled both in English and in Italian, Introduction to Magic. The third volume was just published this year, so they're all available now. It's definitely not for beginners. he wasn't writing it for people who just wanted to find out what occultism is or something. It was for people who were serious about practicing it. So I don't know that it's for everyone. Well, none of Abel's work is for everybody, but I don't even think that the magical books are for everybody who's into Avila. But he considered it very important when he had to flee Rome in 1944, to escape the Western Allies when they occupied Rome. The one thing that he took with him was the manuscripts of Introduction to Magic in his briefcase. So that kind of suggests to you the importance he attached to it. But I think he understood in later life that particular path wasn't for anybody. But there's a lot of, if you read those books, it's not just occult rituals and so forth. There is some stuff about religion. He even writes I remember there's an essay in there on drugs. They're not all written by Avila. They were written by the various people in this group. Only some of them are by Avila. But this other book is more his philosophical idealist writings. It's not occultism in that sense.
All right. Well, we've touched on this already, but inevitably when people hear Avila mentioned, they'll go to Wikipedia and they'll quickly see the word fascist everywhere. And, for some people, understandably, they're like, oh, my God, this is a fascist. What exactly was Avila's relationship with fascism in your view?
Just before we get into that, I just wanted to mention one other thing about you asked me about off the beaten path Avila, but I think people would be interested to know if you go on YouTube and you punch in, Avila interview and you page down through all the stuff about Bannon and so forth, you'll find he recorded a video interview with a French film crew, I think in 1970, not long before his death. That was filmed in his apartment in Rome. And somebody has this guy who goes by the name of Solar Warrior. He's a little bit nutty, but as far as I can tell, the interview is accurately translated. You can watch the video of Avila speaking in French, actually, not Italian, and with English subtitles. And for people who want to get more of a sense of the man, that might be interesting. So I just wanted to throw that in there. As for your question, it's like I talked about before, it's just the problem that Avila is so closely associated with politics now, but it's just, the time that we live in is so hysterical that if you can find any link to fascism or the right or anything these days, and any thinker, then that's how they're going to become known, even if it was only a small part of the totality of what they did. Now, for Avila, I should also recommend there's a book that was just published in English last year, translated from the Italian by Gianfranco De Turris. And it's called Julius Avila, the Philosopher and Magician at War, if I recall correctly. And that is a very exhaustive, dry, historical account of Avila's life from 1943, from when Mussolini was overthrown, to the time that he spent in Vienna working for the SS as an archivist. And then he was injured in a bombing raid in Vienna in January 1945. And then it deals with his life during his long recovery, which took years. He's very severely injured and paralyzed from the waist down, and his recovery and then return to Italy. So it ends around 1951. People who want to know more about his involvement with fascism and the German National Socialists should definitely read this book, because it's just a very straight chronicle of what he was up to at that time. But to the broader issue of his relationship, there isn't an easy answer to that, because strictly speaking, Avila was never a fascist. He was never at any time a member of the fascist party in Italy. He was certainly never a member of the German National Socialist Party. In fact, he gave a lecture to the German SS, I believe in 1938, and the SS was very hostile to his ideas, so they weren't interested in working with him. But at the same time, it can't be denied that Evele was interested in fascism, that he saw not that it was traditional in itself, but that he felt it had the potential to become something that could transform European society into something more traditional again, sort of like a midwife. And he did, of course, edit and publish for various fascist publications. So each person has to decide for themselves how big of a problem that is. Evele himself was put on trial after the war because he kept in touch with people in the 50s and 60s who still described themselves as fascists. So he was actually put on trial on the charge of attempting to revive fascism. And his defense text that he wrote himself, I'm trying to remember where it appears. It has been translated. He famously says in it that, my principles are only those that every sane and well-born person believed in everywhere in the world prior to 1789. So yeah. He did not see himself as a fascist. He saw himself, you could say, as a right winger, but he believed that his principles were those that had governed every society in the world historically prior to the advent of the modern world, which is true. I mean, you can see certainly basically everywhere in the world was a monarchy prior to the coming of modernity. It's only in the last couple of centuries that we've lost monarchies and the various religious institutions as the basis of society. So Evele was hearkening back to an earlier time, and he recognized that fascism was very much a populist modern movement, and he was always very critical of it on those grounds. But he also recognized that he felt it was superior to democracy and communism, and he felt that unlike those ideologies, it had the potential to become something traditional, more traditional over time. But I think you can see in his writings of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, he never lost interest in the right, but he certainly wasn't calling for the revival of fascism. I think he recognized that the flaws within fascism are what had caused it to fail. Well, actually, what he famously wrote in his book on Italian fascism was that fascism didn't fail the Italian people. The Italian people failed fascism. So, but I think he recognized that there was no bringing it back and that wasn't a solution. So while he continued to associate with people from the right in the post-war period, he was never as active as he had been in earlier life.
I also think it's worth mentioning that, fascism was from early 20s until the end of the Second World War. Mm-hmm. It was the government. It was he was living and working in fascist Italy. So it would be virtually impossible not to have any contact with fascists.
He wasn't just an Italian living in fascist Italy. I mean, he did actually have dealings with people who are high ranking in the party, including Mussolini himself, who knew Evele. Mussolini was very impressed with Evele's racial doctrine because he saw it as a way, he wanted a way to adopt a racial ideology for fascism, because Italian fascism had no racial ideology in the earlier years of its existence. But by the late 30s, Mussolini wanted to adopt one, but he didn't want to adopt the German racial ideology. So he saw Evele as a sort of an alternative, if you will. So you could say that Evele's racial position had the support of the Italian state in its final years.
Interesting.
He did have contact with prominent fascists, but he was always critical of it. I mean, another famous statement of his was that he said, I maybe not remember it exactly, but he says something to the effect that insofar as fascism embodies genuine right-wing principles, to that degree, I am a fascist, no less and no more. So, you know, he was acknowledging with that fascism wasn't identical with what he saw as the ideal state.
Is it, just while we're on the subject of Mussolini, is it not true that they also shut down his journal, though, in the early 30s? That Evola started a journal and the state shut it down?
Yeah. I mean, he had problems in the party. He talks about this in Cinnabar, and De Turris as well talks about this a bit in his book. It's been a while since I read those, so I don't remember the specifics, but he certainly had enemies in the fascist party as well as friends. And there were certainly many people who thought that his ideas were nonsense. So it's not that he had some sort of endorsement by the state or anything.
I seem to remember that there was something else that Mussolini read of his that he didn't like, and Evola's reaction was too bad for Mussolini or something like that. So
in the 20s, I think it was in 1928, Mussolini signed a deal with the Vatican, which disappointed some of the more radical fascists because they saw fascism as something that transcended Christianity. And Evola at that time was you know, very anti-Christian. And so he wrote a book, which is actually available in two translations in English. One is called Heathen Imperialism, and the other is Pagan Imperialism. So you could go and read this book if you want. Evola kind of distanced himself from that book in later life. But he's basically attacking fascism for coming to terms with the Vatican, and the Vatican itself condemned the book. Mm-hmm. And the rumor was that Mussolini also disliked the book, but I actually talk about this in one of the footnotes in Cinnabar, but there's an interview that survives with Mussolini where a journalist asked him specifically about this book. And Mussolini actually says, everyone thinks that I had a problem with it, but actually he said, I had no objection at all to Evola writing this book. He said, but the thing is that, I don't remember exactly what he says, but he says something to the effect of Evola was dealing with higher principles and I was dealing with practical necessity in politics. So I didn't mm-hmm. feel that his book had any relevance for for what I was doing, but he made it clear that he didn't have a problem with Evola having written the book.
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, Pagan Imperialism it seems to me that that is the work of a young man, kind of hot and angry. You know,
He was still in his 20s when he wrote it.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, I don't call it like Juvenalia of Evola, but it's certainly like. It's got a very different tone to a lot of his other work. The final question, in the interest of time, I have is this. As we've talked about, you worked on Path of Cinnabar. Some people might say that the different phases of Evola's work see some sudden shifts, or even accuse him of dilettantism. I've actually seen, I can't remember who it was, but it seems to come from like people who are uber specialists in their own area, right? They're like, well, who's this guy coming in? And he writes one book about, Taoism or something, and then, he's off doing something else. Is there a through line that connects the early artistic and philosophical phases with everything from Revolt Against the Modern World and after, or is that kind of traditional turn more of a hard split, in your view?
Well, Evola himself talks about this in Cinnabar. Basically, what he says is that while he recognizes that what he was doing in his Dada period and his philosophical periods was not traditional, he says of Dada that Dada attempted to basically destroy the concept of art that had existed before, it was still the period when Europe was transitioning from classical notions of art to, you know, what we now call modern arts. And which is ironic, since Abel ended up becoming a traditionalist, that he wasn't just a dilettante in Dada. I mean, he was considered after, well, no, it was Zara. I can't remember if he was Italian now. But Abel was, let me just say, Abel was one of the most important Dadaist painters of Italy in the Dada movement. So he wasn't just somebody who was on the sidelines. He was at the center of what was going on. And he says in Cinnabar that it taught him what modernity is, that it's, you know, the dissolution of everything that's traditional. And he said, even though, you know, he didn't understand the role that that plays in the traditional spirit, that it taught him how modernity works, as I recall. I need to go and read this section again, but I think that's the essence of what he says. And that is true, actually. That what's difficult sometimes, especially for people who approach Avila and tradition from the right, is that we're very conditioned to the idea that we get from conservatism that we're trying to save something that's being lost. But for Avila, the important thing isn't about saving a civilization or, you know, the specific artifacts of our civilization, because inevitably, like everything else, those will be destroyed. In modernity, the idea is, you know, to achieve an inner state that is not of the modern world. So, I mean, he wouldn't say that you should therefore be against everything that's traditional in our civilization, but that, you know, you shouldn't be tied to it, because you have to recognize that ultimately it's ephemeral. And of course, part of the traditional approach to history, which is cyclical, is the idea that in order for the new to be born, everything that's old has to be destroyed. So even though modernity seems very disgusting and horrible on the surface, and it is actually part of the process of creation, because when everything is dissolved, then it can reform into something beautiful and truthful again. So, you know, Avila felt that through his experience with Dada and, you know, participating in this process of destroying traditional forms of art, that he grasped something of this spirit. And then, you know, he progressed into the philosophical period, where before he developed more metaphysical traditional ideas about life, that was when he began to explore ideas for how can somebody become a higher man, how can somebody become a truly free man. So you see all the same themes even in that early work. I don't think it's essential that you have to study all that to grasp his later work, but I think there is a connection there, absolutely.
Well, John B. Morgan, thanks a lot for this. Oh, sure. It's been very interesting. Before you go, is there anything that you'd like to promote, or where can people find you, etc.?
Well, I mean, probably the place where I'm most active is on Facebook, so people can always follow my Facebook page, because I write for all sorts of different places, so my writings appear in many different websites and publications. So I can't really give one name for everything, but if people want to find me, just find John Morgan on Facebook. Maybe you can have a link or something when this goes up. But, yeah, best way to follow me.
I'll put the link in the show notes. Well, thank you very much, and we will continue with Avila Day. You'll be somewhere in the schedule when this goes out, and hope people are enjoying it.
Well, I'm always glad to help make Avila better known.